Hey, everybody. Happy summer. Welcome back to First Thursday, the monthly podcast from Labor Relations Information System. My name is Rick Polson. I'm the executive director of LRIS. And welcome back to the podcast. Or if you this is your first time, welcome to the podcast. We do it every month. We usually do it on the first Thursday. How did you figure that out? You may note that this is the second Thursday, and that's just because I'm bad at math. And it was a holiday weekend and all of that good stuff. But we're here in July, and this is a bit of a special pod, I think, this month. I know it's a special pod this month because we're going to be talking about the Supreme Court's recent year, and they just wrapped up their most recent session, their 25-26 session. And normally what we like to do in the summer is kind of read the more important cases and talk to folks about the ones that we think have the most impact on, the labor relations world and specifically public safety labor relations. And so that's what we're going to do. So stick around. It should be a fun episode. Welcome to First Thursday. Okay, before we jump into the cases, and we do have three cases for you this month, I did want to give a quick reminder of our upcoming seminars. We have two seminars remaining in 2026. The first one is going to be September 30th through October 2nd. We are back in Vegas at the Horseshoe. That is a great time of year, by the way, to go to Vegas. Really, really good time of year to be in Vegas. And that's our enforcing the contract. Grievances, discipline, and other workplace rights seminar. And so that's for union and management representatives, lawyers, arbitrators, et cetera. We're going to talk about the contract. How do we enforce it? What are issues related to it? We've got union and management speakers. We have an arbitrator that's going to talk. And so it should be a lot of fun. And then we're back. We're not back in Vegas actually until 2027, but later in 26, we have our discipline seminar, our best practices in public safety discipline seminar, November 4th to the 6th in Nashville. Everybody loves Nashville. So we're going to be there. We're going to be back at the Sonesta, which is a really cool facility. Great place to do a seminar. And that's soup to nuts discipline, the entire, everything you ever wanted to know about public safety discipline from the union side, from the management side. We're going to go through it over 2.5 days. If you want any information about that stuff, check us out at LRIS.com/seminars. And yes, in response to inquiries, we do custom seminars. So LRIS will come to you. We'll come to your state conference. We'll come to a special seminar, in your area if you want. If you have any information or you want any information about what that looks like, just shoot us a line at info@LRIS.com. Thanks for listening. Let's jump into the cases. So what can we say about the Supreme Court's most recent term that was finished? And I would imagine that you guys know that Supreme Court's term ends at the end of June. And usually there's a flurry of cases that are decided in June. They were like really backloaded this year. And so there were a lot of cases, high profile cases that were decided that week leading into, 4th of July weekend. And and lots of news coverage about that. Not a lot of coverage about the cases that really directly concern public safety, labor relations, I don't think. Maybe you feel differently about it, but it really wasn't like a big labor term. Sometimes we have a lot of labor and employment cases that we think are pretty interesting, and there really wasn't a lot going on. No blockbuster labor cases from the Supreme Court, but there were three decisions that I think every public safety labor professional should know a little bit about. None of them arose in a traditional labor setting, right? So none involved bargaining or arbitration or anything like that. Yet all three have the potential to influence the way that public employers and public employees make decisions and the way that labor lawyers litigate the cases that we litigate. And so the three opinions are United States versus Hamani, Margolin versus National Association of Immigration Judges, and Trump v. Slaughter. And they were all decided in June of 2026. So they're relatively hot off the presses. Rather than kind of go through what we normally do, which is kind of review the case, summarize the holding, I really want to focus on why these cases matter or should matter, or I think they matter, to police officers and firefighters and correctional officers and paramedics and union lawyers and, you know, management lawyers. And so that's going to be the focus. And the biggest one, the biggest case, I think, by far, quite frankly, is U.S. versus Hamani. Now, this is the drugs and guns case. And so if you listen to the podcast, you know that a few months ago, we spent an entire episode talking about drugs and guns, and specifically talking about the issue of marijuana and the issue of marijuana use in the workplace by public safety professionals who have to carry guns, and the conflict between your right to engage in otherwise lawful conduct and your right to bear arms. And you do have that right to bear arms. And so if you're interested in all the backstory about that, you know, that was like an hour, whole episode. It was just in March. You can listen to that. I am not going through all that again. But we covered the arguments, the Supreme Court arguments in the Hamani case, you know, kind of gave a little bit of a preview and a little bit of a prediction of how the case was going to turn out. And I was right, you know, in how I thought the case would turn out. I didn't go too far out on a limb, but let's talk a little bit about it. And so, you know, for most folks, Hamani is just like a Second Amendment gun case. But I don't think that that's what makes it interesting, you know, certainly for us. And, you know, what caught my attention, you know, about the case was something a lot more practical. And it was the question of how does this decision affect police officers and correctional officers, and even a few firefighters working in states that have legalized medical or recreational marijuana, right? These employees occupy a pretty unique position. You know, unlike the vast majority of people in our country, carrying a firearm, you know, for those folks isn't just a constitutional right, right? It's an essential function, arguably, of their job. And you have to carry a gun to be a police officer, and in many places to be a correctional officer. And even for some firefighters, depending on the nature of their role, they have to carry a firearm. And so when we're talking about those, you know, firearm rights as it relates to otherwise lawful marijuana conduct, that makes Hamani a public safety labor case, right? Even though on its face it wasn't. And so that's why we're talking about it. And so this is a criminal case. The defendant was a guy by the name of Ali Hamani. He's a Texan. He's born in Texas. He's from the Dallas area. Howdy to our friends down in the Dallas area. We're here in Philadelphia. And so I may like you, I don't like your football team, and that's okay. Ali Hamani, I don't know if he was a Cowboys fan or not, but he lived with his parents and he held a steady job, so he probably wasn't a Cowboys fan. But, you know, nothing jumping out about this guy's background that makes you scream criminal. Lives at home, got a job. He was suspected, and his family suspected, of some terrorism-related activities, right? You know, so not necessarily squeaky clean. And there was a search warrant executed at the family home sometime in 2022. But this isn't a, the investigation wasn't, you know, about what the Supreme Court case was about, right? We had, you know, basically it was a terrorism investigation. Wasn't a drug investigation, wasn't a firearms investigation. And, you know, certainly wasn't something that we would expect to be one of the Supreme Court's biggest Second Amendment cases of the, you know, the last few years. You know, so during the search in 2022, the case notes, you know, say that Hamani was, you know, remarkably cooperative, right? He voluntarily surrendered his gun. He had a Glock pistol in the house. He directed agents to marijuana that he had on the property. He agreed to be interviewed. During his interview, he admitted that he used marijuana. The quote is about every other day, close quote, right? So now he didn't tell them where the cocaine was. They found cocaine. That's not in this case, but, you know, that also happened. You know, Hamani did admit ownership of that, but he maintained that he wasn't using it. He hadn't been regularly using it. And so, you know, right off the bat in this case, like, there's nothing in the facts that suggests violence. There's nothing that suggests threats. There's nothing suggesting any misuse of a firearm. None of that, right? And you keep that in mind, because all that's going to become critical in the court's decision. And it was authored by Justice Gorsuch, by the way. And so, you know, we've got a case that starts out with a government search prompted by really suspicions of terrorism. 6 months after the search, they hadn't brought It took him 6 months to bring the single charge, you know, in the case. And it wasn't terrorism, and it wasn't conspiracy, and it wasn't drug trafficking, and it wasn't even, you know, possession with intent. You know, there was one charge that they brought, and they relied solely on Hamani's admission that he smoked marijuana about every other day. And so they charged him with violating 18 USC section 922 G3. And that's the section of the federal crimes code that makes it illegal for a, quote, unlawful user of a controlled substance to possess a firearm. Right. So if you're an unlawful user of a controlled substance, can't have a gun. He had marijuana. It's a controlled substance. He had a gun. Was he an unlawful user? Well, he said he smoked about every other day. Well, okay. And for the government, that made him an unlawful user. Remember, if you listen to the podcast, or if you've attended any of our seminars when we talk about this, the federal government's interpretation, which has very recently changed, by the way, but the federal government's interpretation of unlawful user is a bit confusing. But one of the ways to interpret that is that if any use within the last year, you're an unlawful user, you know? And that's the standard, you know, that's been used. If you apply for a gun permit, they'll ask you basically that question. And if you are a regular user of marijuana, the federal government considers you to be an unlawful user. And that was the standard that was used back in the 90s, you know, and in the last 15 years, we've had, right, this dramatic spread of medical and recreational marijuana. Whether it's a good thing, whether it's a bad thing, I think it's a bad thing, but isn't really relevant. It's just that we're using the same kind of standard, you know, when the rules were very different, you know, about marijuana. But, you know, that's the test. So they arrest him for violating 922 G3. And, you know, you'll see that, you know, the facts are so important in this case that, you know, it comes up again and again in the decision. You know, the Hamani was arrested because of his marijuana use, right? Not anything he did with his firearm. He had a firearm, but he really was arrested he was prosecuted based on the nature of his use of this particular substance, using it about every other day. And so the government's case, you know, was pretty simple. You know, basically, it's once someone becomes an unlawful user of marijuana, federal law automatically prohibits them from possessing a firearm for any purpose. That's it, right? You know, nothing further than that. And if you use marijuana, you know, more than once in a year, you're an unlawful user, essentially. So they thought it was pretty straightforward, and they had Hamani dead to rights. And so, you know, if you think about that, what doesn't matter? What didn't matter with respect to Hamani? One, was Hamani addicted to drugs? Not a fact in the case. Wouldn't have mattered. Was he intoxicated when he possessed the gun? According to the government, would have mattered. Had he ever threatened anyone in the past? Had marijuana ever impaired his judgment? Why did he have the gun? Was it for self-defense? None of those things, according to the government in the case, if you listen to the argument, were relevant. You know, it's just marijuana user plus firearm equals felony punishable by up to 15 years in jail. The court was very hostile to this position at argument. And I love it when you read these cases, and I get to read these cases, you know, it's pretty fun. I need to get probably a more interesting hobby, but you know, I like reading the beginning, you know, and you usually can tell how a case is going to turn out. You know, you read the first couple of sentences, I'm like, okay, you know, I know where this is headed. And so you get this right from the jump. So Justice Gorsuch, you know, authored the opinion, and he starts out with this line here. So he starts, Ali Hamani uses marijuana a few times a week. That fact alone, the government says, means he is automatically banned from possessing a firearm under federal law, right? You know, that's how it starts. You know, this guy is winning, right? You know, this guy is going to win. The court really focused on, you know, those facts. And so the court's signaling from the very first paragraph that this case is about these weird categorical rules that the government has when it comes to this part of the crimes code. You know, and the government said, we want a rule that automatically disarms basically every regular marijuana user. That's it, without asking any other kind of question about how they act otherwise. You know, the court, you know, wasn't super concerned with marijuana, believe it or not. You'll see some stats thrown out, and, you know, at the beginning of the decision about the number of states that, you know, allow recreational and medical marijuana, you know, all that kind of crap. But it was covered certainly in the media's marijuana case. And it's interesting for us because of its impact, you know, on otherwise lawful marijuana use by public safety personnel. But it isn't really a marijuana case. You know, I mean, the case was about what type of showing the government made or didn't make in this case about this person who was a user of marijuana posing a danger to anyone else. I mean, that comes up, you know, throughout the case. And, you know, Gorsuch goes out of his way, you know, to point out the things that the government didn't allege, right? It never alleged Hamani was an addict. It never said that he had ever mishandled a firearm. He may have mishandled a fire alarm. I don't know. Wasn't in the case. Government never claimed marijuana made him violent. Government never claimed that Hamani posed a danger to himself or anyone else. It was just the guy's a regular marijuana user, right? So it's this distinction, like his status as a regular marijuana user versus any individualized determination of dangerousness that kind of runs, you know, throughout this opinion. Now, the opinion, you know, applies the rule that governs government limitations on Second Amendment rights. And the court's most recent and broadest statement of that came out of a decision that it issued in 2022, I'm going to say, coming out of New York City. It was a handgun ban. And that's the Bruin decision. And, you know, there's a framework here, right? And really, whenever there's a Second Amendment challenge, you know, there's two parts. And so is, does the government action, you know, at issue here, does it somehow limit conduct that's also covered by an amendment, right? So here, does the government limit somebody's possession and use of a firearm? Yes, it does, right? You can't have a gun if you're a regular marijuana user. So Second Amendment's implicated. Once the amendment's implicated, the court says, okay, now the burden is on the government to demonstrate that, you know, its restriction is consistent with what the court has called our nation's historical tradition of firearm regulation. And so, you know, we call this the historical tradition test. And, you know, the court has gone out of its way, you know, since when in a couple of cases, two cases since Bruin, to say, listen, you know, it doesn't mean that, you know, we don't need a historical twin, right? But we have to identify regulations that were at least what the court says relevantly similar, both in their purpose and their operation, that existed back in 1791. You know, as compared to the current regulation. Now, people, you know, I mean, this is what the Supreme Court does. You know, they do a lot of things, but they interpret the Constitution. And there are different trains of thought on that, right? We've got one amendment anyway that dates to 1791, and so are we supposed to kind of go back in the Wayback Machine and only apply our understanding of the world in 1791 to, you know, today's world, or are we supposed to take the position that the Constitution, you know, is this kind of living, breathing document that evolves over time? I mean, the truth is somewhere in between, right? You know, the world is not the same today as it was in 1791. It's not the same today as it was in 1991. But, you know, you think about the world in 1791, right? You know, this is a police, fire, EMS, corrections podcast. All right, there weren't police departments. You know, there were no fire departments, no COs, right? No DEA, no federal drug laws, no marijuana legalization, no administrative agencies. People owned people, by the way. Half the country couldn't, well, more than half the country couldn't vote, right? Yeah, so the world was a little bit, hey, I'm in like the northeast part of the country. There was no air conditioning. That alone, right? You know, makes the point that it was very different in 1791. And so are we stuck? Is there no room for evolution? And, you know, that's the debate that just kind of goes on through the ages. And you can read it, you know, in decision after decision, discussions among and between Supreme Court justices about that issue. And again, I think that, you know, if you look at, you know, some people would say America is the great Ken Burns quote that, you know, the three things America really contributed to the world were the Constitution, jazz, and baseball. I don't think the world has accepted baseball, by the way. I like it, but I do think that the Constitution and jazz, he's probably got a point there. And the Constitution, you know, does evolve over time. And so how do we take those principles that existed in the 1790s and apply them without watering them down? You know, how do we apply them accurately so that they reflect the intent of the framers? You know, that's what bigger brains than I wrestle with, and that's what they're supposed to do in the court. And so they're supposed to, as it relates to the regulation at issue in Hamani, you know, the burden on the government was to go back and to prove, right, essentially prove that this gun limitation, you know, 922 G3, was consistent with America's historical tradition of regulating firearm rights. And so what was the historical tradition that the government identified in Hamani? They're really clear, habitual drunkards. The government argued, and that's the term, habitual drunkards, right? The government argued that early American laws very often restricted the liberty of habitual drunkards, you know, because intoxication created risks to the public. And because of that, because we had regulations limiting the rights of habitual drunkards, we could similarly restrict firearm possession by unlawful users of controlled substances. You know, and so it's not like they made it up, right? You know, there's good lawyers on both sides. You know, it's not necessarily an unreasonable analogy. The problem, at least according to the court in this case, is that history doesn't actually support the government's description of those laws. And they go through it in the opinion. And so, you know, Gorsuch, you know, kind of really rips the government in this when he says that the government's analogy fails, quote, on every metric it invites us to consider. That sucks. You don't want that in the decision, in your decision. You know, I don't want the judge saying that my arguments failed on every metric we invited them to consider. But that's what the justice says, you know, and that's a pretty devastating sentence because it tells you it wasn't a close question in the court's view. 9-0 decision, by the way. You know, the government argued, right, that modern marijuana users should be treated like historical habitual drunkards, and the court said that that comparison just doesn't work. You know, the purpose of those historical laws was different. The people they targeted were different. The procedures that were required under those laws were very different, and the consequences were different. And when the court looked at all those together, the analogy completely collapsed. You know, and one of the most interesting sections of the opinion involves, you know, it's kind of like a history lesson about like who was a habitual drunkard, you know, in the 18th and 19th centuries. And, you know, the court explains and they walk through it. A habitual drunkard was not someone who drank regularly. By the way, everybody drank regularly back then, right? And there were questions from the justices. Oh, Sam Adams used to drink a pint of whiskey every day. And was he a habitual drunkard? I would suggest today, if you drink a pint of whiskey every day, you might want to talk to somebody about that. But, you know, the idea was that that kind of conduct, that kind of drinking back then really wasn't problematic. And, you know, and so they weren't the people who were in the crosshairs of people drafting laws against habitual drunkards. Instead, those laws, you know, generally targeted people who had become so intoxicated that they could no longer manage their own affairs, right? And so Gorsuch quotes in the decision, historical authorities describing people who had become, quote, incapable of conducting their own affairs, quote, mentally incompetent, or those who had, quote, lost the power of self-control, right? So that's a far cry, I think, from someone who occasionally or even regularly or even very regularly consumes marijuana, but otherwise functions, you know, relatively normally in everyday life. And so that was a pretty big distinction. Now, what about this issue of dangerousness? And you read that opinion, one word keeps jumping off the page. It is dangerous, right? Again and again and again and again. The court points out that the government never attempted to prove that Hamani was actually dangerous, right? You know, Gorsuch notes that under the government's interpretation, a person could lose their right to own a firearm. The person could, let's state it this way, a person could lose a constitutional right regardless of how much marijuana he used, right? Regardless of why he possessed a firearm, regardless of whether he had ever threatened anyone ever, right? And regardless whether his marijuana use had ever made him dangerous to himself or others. You know, that emphasis on individualized dangerousness and whether the government proves same drives the entire opinion. And if you read that decision, the words danger or dangerous are in there 31 times, right? So this case, it's not about marijuana. You know, it's about really whether the government can presume someone is dangerous simply because they belong to a broad category. And in this instance, the broad category was a regular marijuana user. Really interesting. You know, the court also questions kind of whether Congress even drew the right line in drafting this particular provision of the Controlled Substances Act. And Justice Gorsuch observed that the act itself was enacted primarily to protect the health and general welfare of the American people, not to identify people who are uniquely dangerous with firearms. And he notes, you know, several modern developments, which, you know, do in fact undermine the government's position. And, you know, we all see this. We see the weird mixed messaging on marijuana. And again, I'm not a fan of the expanded access to marijuana. But you certainly see that there's a lot of dissonance between federal and certain states' treatment of marijuana. And that was flat out stated in the opinion. Justice Gorsuch notes that the Department of Justice, significantly curtailed prosecutions involving marijuana. You know, that most states, you know, permit marijuana use in some form. The federal government, has moved forward to reclassifying marijuana. Now, the case was argued before the Schedule 3 to Schedule 1 reclassification. That happened in April, but it had happened by the time the decision was issued, right? So the court notes all these things and says that, you know, we have to be careful about giving government broad power to designate any group as dangerous, you know, and therefore disqualifying its members from having a gun, in a way that would, you know, essentially quickly swallow, the justice said, the Second Amendment, you know. And so, yeah, in this case involves marijuana, but there's a lot of suspicion about the government and kind of broad categorical restrictions. And that you read that through the decision. Now, that said, the court really took steps to make clear that its opinion is supposed to be pretty narrow. The court goes out of its way at the end of the decision to explain what its decision does not accomplish, and it specifically says this. It says that, you know, we're not deciding whether addicts may be prohibited from possessing firearms. We're not deciding whether people who are presently intoxicated may be prohibited from possessing firearms. We're not deciding whether Congress could adopt, you know, a different scheme, maybe a more narrowly tailored statute aimed at particulars of a, you know, of users of a particular drug. And the court says that it's not deciding whether the government could prosecute someone if they actually proved that the person's drug use made him dangerous, right? And so, you know, they're deciding it based on the facts before them in the Hamani case. Now, you know, it's not disingenuous, right? You know, because you're saying, look, I'm just only going to decide these are the facts before us. That's all we're going to decide. Hey, could have been any other case. It's not this case. You know, that's presuming that the court has no role in deciding which cases they take. And of course they do, right? You know, and so, you know, you have to ask the Supreme Court to take your case and they're going to review it and they might take it. And so they take it with an understanding of the facts, you know, and so they know what the facts are. And, but I think that the court, I think rightly so, you know, took steps to say, look, we're not saying that this means that every Section 922 G3 conviction goes out the window. We're saying on these facts, this conviction does. And, you know, that's why we were watching the case, right? Because, you know, we're talking about a person, an American, right, who was a regular user of this substance, a lawful user of marijuana, who poses no threat, right? There's no danger. There's no individualized showing of danger. And if you think about that, right, isn't that every police officer or deputy sheriff, you know, or armed correctional officer, right? They carry firearms because they're required to do. They may also choose to off work, but they carry firearms because their employer requires them to do so. There's no, you know, the regular cop on the street, there's no question about whether they're a dangerous individual. You know, if you're a dangerous individual, you're probably not going to keep that job very long. And so, you know, if we have a state that legalizes recreational marijuana and we have a police officer that lawfully uses marijuana while off duty, you know, under their state law, and when they show up for work, they're completely sober and they qualify regularly with their firearm and they can perform every function of their job, have they committed a crime, you know, or can their department, you know, terminate them, right? And before Hamani, a lot of employers would just look at that federal statute and say, well, that conduct that you engaged in, that's a felony. Whether you're prosecuted or not, that's a felony. And you can't engage in illegal conduct off duty. I think after Hamani, the conversation becomes a lot more complicated, and that's why we're talking about it. So, you know, there aren't immediate changes flowing from the decision into employment law. You know, departments are still free to establish, you know, reasonable drug policies. States, you know, can and do regulate police and fire and corrections certification to perform those jobs. Collective bargaining agreements still govern discipline. We still have fitness for duty standards, all of those types of things. But I think that this underlying legal conversation has shifted. And so as it relates to marijuana and otherwise lawful marijuana, particularly in my view, as it relates to random testing. So if someone pops hot on a random test for marijuana, they haven't given any indication that they're impaired. There's no showing of danger. There's no nothing, right? What are we doing disciplining that person? You know, is there any basis to do that? And so I want to watch. We're going to keep an eye on this, and we'll keep reporting out on, you know, new developments. But, you know, it'll be interesting to see how employers react to this. And do they continue to rely on kind of federal criminal law, as many have, or certification agencies certainly have? You know, what are arbitrators going to do? Are they going to start looking for individualized evidence of impairment, you know, rather than these kind of categorical assumptions? Are lawyers going to, you know, point to cases like Hamani to say, yeah, that's what you're going to have to do? I certainly will. Will certification boards revisit their rules? I'm in Pennsylvania. I would suggest that MOPEC, which is Pennsylvania's police certification board, is going to have to go back and revisit their rules as it relates to a police officer, Pennsylvania police officers, otherwise lawful use of medical marijuana, which I think, as we sit here today, would cost them their certification. That's probably an unconstitutional limitation that MOPEC would impose there. Lots of other states have taken a more hands-off position because of those constitutional concerns. And so, you know, none of those questions are answered by Hamani, but they're, you know, I suspect they're coming down the pike, and that's why we're talking about it. So that was case number one. Case number two is Margolin versus National Association of Immigration Judges. This case disappoints me. Yeah, because when I first heard about this particular case, I forget where it was, you know, in its development, but I was interested. And when the court took the case, I was like, oh, this is great, because we're probably going to get now in another, you know, Supreme Court public employee speech case, right? Great. We love that. We talk about those all the time at LRIS. And what did we get? Nothing. You know, we got Bupkis. We got a decision that got really no decision, no discussion of the First Amendment at all. And, you know, having reviewed the case and thought about it, that's actually exactly why I think this case deserves our attention and deserves our discussion. And so let's talk a little bit about Margolin. This case involves immigration judges. Well, geez, that's not trendy, right? You know, so immigration judges, and specifically immigration judges, things that they can say off duty. So if you go and talk at a law school or at a graduation or a bar association, you know, immigration is in the news, right? And so, you know, if we have an immigration judge, they can come and talk about things that are happening today. You know, they can't talk about cases before them, but they can give their opinions generally on things. And some judges did. You know, that can be a problem, right? You know, you have an administration that wants to keep messaging on point. You always want to control the message, right? As any executive, regardless of what party you're in. If you got your people out there spouting off about, you know, the department that they work in, is that going to undermine confidence in the department? That's assuming confidence in the department existed anyway, but, that's what we had. We had immigration judges, right, in a, during the, at the start of the current Trump administration, where immigration is like the number one issue. It's still probably the number one controversial, you know, issue associated with the second Trump term. At the outset of the term, the Executive Office for Immigration Review, which essentially governed the conduct of immigration judges, right? So the executive office adopts a new policy. And the new policy requires immigration judges to get supervisory approval before giving any public speeches related to their official duties, right? And they say in there that the policy is intended to ensure the public statements carry the office's, you know, stamp of approval, and that the messaging remain consistent with official agency positions. And so you've got basic, think about your department, your agency, right? Saying, we don't want you out there talking. If you're going to be talking about anything that has to do with public safety, you need our approval first. And because we want to make sure that your messaging is consistent with ours. And that's probably exactly what your agencies do. Well, what happened was they got sued, and they got sued by the National Association of Immigration Judges. So it's not a union, right? But it's kind of a union. And that's why it's interesting to me. So you have a speech restriction imposed by an agency, a federal agency, and the association, professional association of that particular category of employees sued, saying this is essentially a prior restraint on speech, you know, by our members. And we want to challenge this because what we think is a pretty clear, you know, First Amendment violation and probably a content-based, you know, restriction. That's why the case is interesting, right? You know, but what happened with the case? Well, it went sideways because it looked at the outset, it looked like a classic public employee speech case, right? You know, could the government require these judges to obtain permission before speaking publicly? You know, are we going to apply what we call the Pickering balancing test, where we weigh the employee's right to say what they have to say versus the government's right to run an efficient government? It's just a phrase that always makes me chuckle. You know, and how much speech protection do government employees, you know, receive when they're talking about matters connected to their jobs? And we've got a whole line of cases since the Supreme Court's Garcetti decision that helps flesh that out. So this is any opportunity for the Supreme Court to ring in on this stuff. I'm all about it. I think they're fascinating questions. And the court, of course, did not consult with me and answered none of them. And so they're not the only court that didn't answer them. The Fourth Circuit, you know, before the Supreme Court didn't answer them, and neither did the Federal District Court. Why not? Well, after the judges sued, or the judges association sued, the district court dismissed the case because it held that under the Federal Civil Service Reform Act, the judges had to pursue their challenge basically through the administrative review process. That's a part of it comes under the jurisdiction of the Merit Systems Protection Board, right? Rather than filing a lawsuit directly in federal district court. And if you think about this in terms of, like, you know, straight labor law at the state level, you know, if you have a speech policy in your department, and the department unilaterally changes that, and you may, you know, it's a speech issue, and you sue the department for some new limitation on speech, it's essentially the equivalent of the department saying, yeah, if you don't like this unilateral change to working conditions, go to the labor board. You know, that's part of our statutory scheme. That's where you have to go first, you know, before suing us in district court. That's essentially what happened, you know, but at the federal level, you know, kind of in a broader sense, in the Margolin case. And so the court dismissed the case, and it went up to the Fourth Circuit. And I think people probably expected the same outcome there in the Fourth Circuit, or maybe the circuit would actually get to and look at the merits. But the court did something weird. It didn't address the speech arguments at all. And it didn't it didn't address even an argument that anybody made, right? What the Fourth Circuit said was that, well, you know, yeah, there's this statutory scheme that requires an administrative review of these types of changes, and the Merit Systems Protection Board has jurisdiction over those changes, but the federal government is a shit show these days, right? Have you read the papers? Have you looked around, right? And what's been happening at the Merit Systems? This is the Fourth Circuit, me as the Fourth Circuit saying, have you seen what's happening there? The president fired the special counsel to the MSPB. The president removed, right, two members of the MSPB. Was essentially turning this into not an independent agency, and we'll talk about that in the next case, but just really another wing of the Trump administration. And so given that we know that, is the Merit Systems Protection Board as it stands today the same type of system that existed when Congress passed the Civil Service Reform Act? you know, and the court, you know, raised that issue on its own, by the way. Not the plaintiffs never argued it. The defendants certainly never argued it. And what the court said is, no, I want to send this back. And they remanded it to the circuit court, or to the district court, to engage in fact-finding on whether the Civil Service Reform Act's review process was actually operating the way that Congress intended, right? Because maybe if Congress knew that the Merit Systems Protection Board was going to become a shit show, it wouldn't have required cases to go there, and we wouldn't have delayed, you know, the treatment of you know, maybe potentially significant impositions on constitutional rights. Pretty interesting, you know, an extraordinary thing that the Fourth Circuit did. And you know, usually when courts do extraordinary things, there's a consequence, and the consequence here is that the federal government asked the Supreme Court to take the case, and they did. And you know what the court said was that the Fourth Circuit went too far, and they reversed the decision based on this, the principle of party presentation, right? And what does that really mean? It means the parties decide, really, or the parties are supposed to decide what issues are presented to a court, right? You know, the court doesn't just kind of like think, hey, what's an interesting issue that comes out of this case that I can address? No, the parties identify the issues. The parties raise the issues. The parties argue the issues. Party could miss an issue. That's my job, right? That's a lawyer's job. What are the issues? What are the arguments that need to be made? It's not the judge's job, or it shouldn't be, at least under this theory. It shouldn't be the judge's job to do that, right? You know, you're just supposed to, you know, call balls and strikes, right? You're not supposed to go up to the pitcher's mound and say, well, let me throw it. Right, which is kind of, you know, one way of describing this. And so, you know, judges are supposed to just decide issues that parties raise before them. They're not supposed to create new cases that nobody argued. And it's straight out of the decision. The quote is, we rely on the parties to frame the issues for decision, and we decide only the questions presented. Right? That's the court talking to the public, but it's also the Supreme Court talking to every other federal court in the land, right? We rely on parties to frame issues, and we decide only the questions presented. Great line, you know, citing prior Supreme Court decisions, you know, criticizing what the Fourth Circuit did here. And the quote is, federal courts are not roving commissions licensed to sally forth each day looking for wrongs to right, right? The court's saying that's not what we do. We're not policymakers. The, you know, Congress has a role. The executive has a role. We're supposed to be referees, and Chief Justice Roberts loves to talk about calling balls and strikes. Now you can criticize that, and there's plenty. If you want to, we want to start criticizing the Chief Justice. You know, that's a whole other podcast, and there certainly are valid criticisms that can be made. But you know, he said it. We're just supposed to call balls and strikes. We're not supposed to pitch and catch and all that other kind of stuff. We decide disputes that are brought to us, and nothing more. And, you know, that's why we're talking about the case. You know, it's a really good reminder that courts, even though we look to courts, right, to resolve constitutional disputes, they generally are going to avoid the more meaty questions wherever they can, or they should, you know, and let's not think about that as judicial cowardice, right? It's, we call that judicial restraint. So if a case can be decided on jurisdiction, or failure to exhaust, or on waiver of an argument, or on failure to preserve an issue, you know, the court usually addresses those issues and it stops there. It doesn't go forward and say, oh, and in addition, let me opine about what might have happened if they had done a better job as lawyers, and here's what the law should say, and all that. Because some judges, by the way, will still do that. And, you know, I don't think they should. And, you know, that's what the why we're talking about the Margolin's decision, because, you know, that stuff happens all the time in labor. Right. You know, like we want to know, we want to get an answer to the meaty issue, you know, but, you know, when I look at the case, you know, we have an arbitration. It's like, well, what the real fight is, was the grievance timely? You know, was the issue preserved? You know, were the remedies that should have been exhausted, you know, before we went down this road? Was there a Loudermill hearing? Right? You know, are we in the correct forum? All of these things are incredibly important, you know, and, you know, if we want to just slough it off as, oh, that's just procedure, we want to talk about substance. Well, you know, no. You know, procedure is the substance, you know, most of the time. And so, you know, the rule for us and the thing to remember is that procedure is going to determine whether we ever get to substance. And so, you know, even though I was excited about the case and I wanted to get a new Supreme Court, you know, speech case in the books that I could talk about, you know, after I read the opinion, I wasn't disappointed anymore. You know, I realized and remembered, you know, this case isn't really about public employee speech. You know, the court was really about how courts function, you know, or how courts are supposed to function. And as lawyers, we love those constitutional questions, man. But a lot of times judges never get there. And, you know, for the folks who listen to this podcast, it's important to understand, right? You know, that like understanding how courts decide cases is just as important as understanding the principles themselves behind the cases. And so it's a pretty interesting decision and pretty interesting backstory. And that's why we talked about it. You know, why don't you take a read and let us know what you think. Okay, last case, Trump v. Slaughter. You knew we had to get Trump's name in one of these things. You know, I don't know. I've been doing this a long time, and I've seen administrations come and go. And you know, you do anything long enough, I guess. But you do stuff in the public sector long enough, you notice something every 4 years. You know, labor lawyers start saying the same thing, right? Well, the NLRB's changed. You know, the EEOC's changed. The MSPB's changed. The FLRA's changed, right? You know, and it's true. And, you know, usually we attribute that to politics. And this Trump v. Slaughter decision isn't a groundbreaker, but it kind of explains the constitutional theory behind why those changes occur. And so that's why we're talking about it. And the backstory here, it's a case involving the Federal Trade Commission. And the Trump v. Slaughter case, you know, has been written about and talked about. Not for the reasons that I'm talking about it. You know, but you can see plenty about this case, and if you're interested, go, you know, go check it out. But this is a case involving, I guess, in theory, the Federal Trade Commission. And so we have five commissioners of the Federal Trade Commission. They serve 7-year terms, and the terms are staggered. And for almost 100 years, federal law, right, said that those commissioners could be removed only for cause. Right. And the reasons in the statute basically say you can remove a commissioner, an FTC commissioner, for inefficiency, for neglect of duty, or for malfeasance in office. And the insinuation there is that the FTC is designed to be an independent federal agency. I love malfeasance, by the way. Like, it's just, I mean, I don't love engaging in malfeasance, although sometimes I do enjoy engaging in malfeasance. It's just one of those great words, and no one ever understands it. You know, malfeasance and misfeasance and nonfeasance and like, what's feasance? And, you know, feasance, right? It's French, the fair to do, right? So feasance is doing something, right? And so just a little primer, malfeasance is doing something you're not supposed to do. Misfeasance is doing something you're supposed to do, but doing it poorly. And nonfeasance is just not doing anything, not doing something about, you know, not doing something you're supposed to do, right, at all. So if a chief steals money from the evidence room, right, that's malfeasance. If a chief conducts an investigation but botches it, that's misfeasance. And if a chief simply ignores doing anything, doesn't investigate anything, that's nonfeasance, right? So malfeasance, misfeasance, nonfeasance. Malfeasance in office is what can get somebody pulled, somebody could lose a job as a federal commissioner. For the folks who listen to this, you know, podcast, it's basically a just cause standard, right? You can't just say you're at will, you got to go. I'm the new president. I want people who see the world my way. You got to split. By the way, why are there staggered terms? Like, so that this doesn't happen, you know, so that there's some consistency. And the idea behind that is that like our policies as a country shouldn't completely change on a dime the minute a new president takes office, because like there's important stuff that these agencies are supposed to deal with. That's the argument, right? And the countervailing argument is, no, we have elections and elections have consequences, and the president needs to run the country like a CEO, and it means he needs to make quick changes, and those changes need to reflect his priorities that in theory are supposed to reflect the will of the electorate, right? So these two competing visions, I'm not suggesting that, you know, both are valid. I think one is wrong and one is right, but you know, both are valid. And so what happened, right? So there was an election in 2024, President Trump wins. At the time that he started his second term, there are only two Republicans on the FTC, which makes sense, right? You're replacing a Democratic administration. And so we only have two R's. The chair, Lina Khan, resigned from the FTC. And so we were at a 2-2 tie, two R's and two D's. And then in March of 25, pretty early on, the president gets rid of the two Democratic commissioners. And he didn't accuse them of misconduct. You know, he didn't, no pun intended, trump up some charges or anything. He just said, look, your continued service is, quote, inconsistent with this administration's priorities. And he removed them pursuant to what he alleged was his Article II authority under the Constitution, right? So it's a very clean constitutional question for the Supreme Court. You know, how far does the president's authority go with respect to removing commissioners who are governed in theory by a statute that requires cause, right? And we just talked about a case that says, no, we have to follow what the Civil Service Reform Act says, even though we have important constitutional issues. Well, let's see what the court did with this. Chief Justice Roberts authored the opinion. And, you know, there's actually not a lot in this opinion about the FTC, you know, even though it's about an FTC commissioner, there's very little about it. And Justice Roberts goes back in his Wayback Machine back to, you know, when the Constitution was drafted. He actually goes all the way back to 1776, and he says, like, immediately after independence, many states intentionally created weak governors, right? You know, that was by design, because we feared monarchy, or they feared monarchy. And that the framers of the Constitution, you know, a few years later concluded that that was a mistake. Having many weak executives for fear of monarchy was a problem, and that the framers decided to fix that problem by creating one president, right? And the idea there was that someone, one person, needed to be accountable for executing the laws. And, you know, you pretty much know how the decision is going to come down now, if you know that. And, you know, the entire opinion just revolves around this one idea. And Chief Justice Roberts quotes Alexander Hamilton's observation that a single executive promotes energy, you know, while making it clear on whom the blame ought really to fall, right? And so we have to have a strong president, a strong executive, so that we know who's responsible for things, is the idea. And according to the court, if the president's responsible for faithfully executing the laws, then the president must also control the people who execute the laws, right? Otherwise, that responsibility becomes meaningless. Another thing that Justice Roberts discussed in the decision, in his decision, was what's called the decision of 1789. And this was happening with Congress in 1789 debating whether executive officers of an administration could be removed only with Senate approval. And he cites James Madison arguing that removal power was essential because it preserved what he called the quote chain of dependence, right? And so the lowest officers, the middle grade, and the highest all had to be accountable to the president. And ultimately, the president had to be accountable to the people, right? And Justice Roberts cites all this, you know, not just as a history level, but to say this is the foundation, you know, of all these kind of modern removal cases that we're dealing with. The court then revisited 90 years of Supreme Court jurisdiction stemming from a case called Humphrey's Executor, decided in 1935. And the court says, yeah, but the Federal Trade Commission is very different, you know, from the agency that existed back when we determined that you couldn't just remove a commissioner, right? People thought, hey, the law's been decided on this issue for almost 100 years. The court should just kind of continue to do what it has been doing. But Roberts says, nope, the FTC is very different. Today, it writes rules, it investigates business, it brings enforcement actions, it conducts administrative adjudications, it files lawsuits, there, you know, and all those things are executive functions, you know, according to the Chief Justice. And then because the FTC exercises this executive power, Roberts concluded that its commissioners, you know, have to be removable by the president, right? And so wow, you know, you forget about the FTC, but you think about other agencies, right? I think about the National Labor Relations Board, right? Or the Federal Labor Relations Board, or the Merit Systems Protection Board, the EEOC. You know, each administration appoints different leaders, and different leaders have different priorities, and those priorities are going to produce different labor law, but it kind of funnels through, it filters through, it doesn't, you know, happen so quickly, right? You know, businesses need to plan. You know, we heard this with the tariff criticism. Like if I'm going to build a factory, like I need to understand what the tariff rules are going to be before I invest. You know, I can't just change the foundation of my business every 6 months if someone changes their mind. You know, businesses need to have some type of certainty, you know, in labor law, or some type of consistency, I should say, in labor law, in order to function appropriately. And if we go to this at-will system that too closely reflects what can be really significantly changing priorities from election to election, you know, what is that going to do, right, to the business environment or any other environment? And so, you know, and when you think about that, you know, what's the difference between the United States and your city, right? You know, aren't all these arguments get to the heart of just cause protections, you know, either that exist by statute or in contracts, right? If, you know, we have a mayor that is elected and the mayor has a particular view of how a police department should run, you know, should they have to bargain with their police union over those changes? Should they have to, you know, shouldn't they be able to weed out the officers that they want to weed out, right? Isn't, you know, I hear all that. None of that comes through Justice Roberts' opinion in the Slaughter case, but I'm hearing it, right? I'm reading it in between the lines. Like, that's the worldview. And, you know, this notion of the strong executive is, you know, clearly it's where the Supreme Court is right now. You know, the case isn't about, you know, Rebecca Slaughter or about the FTC. It's about executive control. And this court with this issue, you know, clearly came down with an opinion that, you know, provides a constitutional explanation for something that kind of, you know, we've seen, you know, for decades. And it's, the law doesn't change when Congress passes a statute. You know, a lot of times the law changes because the people enforcing the statute change, right? And what the Supreme Court did in the Slaughter case essentially was open the door for those changes to be more dramatic and to occur more quickly. And, you know, there's going to be another presidential election in 2.5 years. And, you know, people may feel very differently about this rule. If it goes the other way, you're going to have the exact same stuff and we're all just going to get whiplash. And whether that's good for society, I don't know. I suspect this probably isn't. And, you know, so that's where the third case ended up. And so, you know, we've got these three cases, again, not a big labor term. You know, and the cases don't really seem to have, you know, much in common, right? Guns and marijuana, immigration judges, the Federal Trade Commission. But I think there was a little bit of a through line. I mean, each case reminds us that the, you know, the court often changes the rules indirectly, right? And sometimes that's by requiring a more individualized decision-making by the government, like we saw in Hamani. Sometimes it's by insisting on procedural discipline, right? As we saw in Margolin, rather than getting to the juicy, you know, substantive issue, you know, we need some discipline here. And sometimes, you know, the court changes things by shaping the structure of government itself, which, you know, it may have done in Slaughter. And those structural decisions, you know, eventually work their way into our world, you know, which is why they're worth our attention and our discussion, I think, and I hope. And we'll continue that discussion, you know, on the podcast and at our seminars. And I'm interested in what you think about it. You know, if you want to share your opinion on those decisions, or if there's one that you thought was particularly important, you drop me a line at info@lrs.com. As always, if you have enjoyed the podcast, you think it's not a complete and total waste of your time or someone else's time, share it with someone else, you know, text it around, like, follow, all that good stuff that people are supposed to do with podcasts. It does help us and we greatly appreciate it. And come on out and see us at a seminar. You can check that out at lrs.com/seminars. I think that's it for the month of July. Happy sesquicentennial from the birthplace of liberty here in Philadelphia. I hope you all have a wonderful July, and I look forward to talking to you again in August. Rick Paulson signing off.